accession number 4666, reel 4.
Lord Gridley, reel 4.
I was going to say, I've given you the account of the Japanese Kempeitai visiting the jail. At the end of the first day, there were about 10 arrests made, and they were taken away for further interrogation at Japanese Kempeitai headquarters in Singapore. And then a great period of fear descended upon Changi Jail. We didn't know what had happened to these chaps who had been taken away from us. We gathered that they were kept under the most appalling conditions, which subsequently proved to be true, where they were kept in one cell with no drinking water. They were given no drinking water at all. They had to go to the end of the cell there. This is fact, I know it for fact, and a drink from the water closet in the corner. They were given nothing to lie down with at night and go to sleep. They were made to sit up the whole day on the floor with their hands across their knees, and any sign of them moving from that position, they were beaten mercilessly by the Japanese Kempeitai. The whole object of that detention, which I know about, which I have subsequently told you about, I was to get certain information about them, about events which had happened in the harbours of Singapore.
Did the treatment of the internees as a whole deteriorate as a result of this incident?
I don't think it deteriorated. We had got ourselves pretty well established at that time by running our own. The Japanese supplied us with rice. We had our organised kitchen functioning very efficiently. We had our hospital functioning fairly efficiently. Apart from the awful fear which, as I just described to you, descended on the jail, I can't say that our treatment in any way deteriorated internally.
To give me a description of what a typical day in the camp's life would be, the routine from the beginning of the day to the end of it.
Yeah. Well, in the morning, we were quite used to getting up at an early hour, which would be about 7:30 a.m., breakfast would be come round and was generally served in the kitchen and in the dining rooms of the jail, of which there were three in each block, the blocks being A, B, C and D. Our morning meal generally consisted of a cup of tea and a ration of rice mixed up with palm oil and a few vegetables. And after that, people would be mustered for the various duties which were detailed to be carried out during that day. Parties would be assembled for going outside the camp under prison guards to work in the prison gardens as we had then established them. I think earlier on I spoke to you about growing sweet potatoes. We also grew green leaf vegetables such as spinach, and we were very successful in cultivating something like 7 or 8 acres of ground over a period of time. People from the kitchens would come out about 11 o'clock to cut the ration of vegetables and dig up the ration of vegetables for the day. Other parties would be assembled in the prison courtyard under Japanese guards to go in two or three times a week on the camp lorry to fetch in supplies of rice and that kind of thing. People who were not fit enough to go out were not instructed, but were expected under a certain amount of surveillance, which we carried out ourselves, to clean out their cells, to attend to duties of that kind. A large number of people would go to lectures, which had been organised by the camp administration, things of topical interest. We had experts in there from the University of Malaya, professors and so on, who had been interned and were fully capable of giving the most interesting talks. That went on till about 1 o'clock. In the afternoon, we were generally allowed to have a considerable amount of free time, which would be spent washing our clothes in the basins and bathrooms which were available. I can't quite remember where this was done, but I think what we did was to collect pails of water from a standpipe, and with a certain amount of soap which was issued, wash our clothes in that way. In the evening, in the latter part, when the Japanese became more humane as the war went against them, that in about the last year before we were released, we put on some very fine concerts there. I think that roughly represents our day. Unofficial things went on, of course, and that was the reception of the news by our secret people who had wireless receiving sets which were hidden in various parts of the jail, and where we always received the BBC overseas service news every night. And this was memorized. It may have been written down in original by the person who received it, but it was passed to various block commandants, which I have explained to you, which existed within the camp. They would assemble their floor representatives, and the news would be repeated, so that by that arrangement, we were able fairly successfully to relay the news received that day to every person who was in the camp. And he would know how the war was going, and there's no doubt at all that that organisation kept people alive who might otherwise have chucked in and given up the ghost. I think that was a fairly typical day. We had people always in the hospitals, the prison hospitals, where we had doctors, our own doctors, who would look after them. We were always short of drugs. We were always pleading for the Japanese, let us have more drugs. I think I have explained to you that early on, one of the great difficulties from which we suffered from was a lack of medicine and a lack of basic applications of medicinal properties, or what would you call it? People suffered from ulcers. That was through malnutrition. And quite a lot of chaps had weeping ulcers on their legs. And also they suffered from swollen joints, which was a result of a lack of vitamins, a lack of protein, really. Too many carbohydrates and not enough protein in the diet. The camp committee used to meet very regularly, and all difficulties would be relayed to them, and they would be in possession of the issues which were worrying internees, so that there was never any doubt that the matters which might be bothering a man in those conditions, if they tended to be considered serious, they would be brought to the attention of the camp committee as and when these things occurred. I don't know what else there is to cover there.
About the medication that was available to internees, what kind of drugs did you
have? Well, it's very interesting that, because on the first anniversary of our internment in the jail, the Japanese tried to become very magnanimous, and on Tenno Heiko's birthday — now Tenno Heiko is the way of describing the Emperor of Japan, and I will spell it for you later on — they thought it advisable to show a little bit of kindness, or their way of showing kindness, so they presented us with a locally distilled brandy, and our doctors got hold of this. There was quite a large quantity came into the camp, and this was used for dressing wounds. It was never distributed to us. I mean, I know this for a fact, and I was part of the people who had to inform the people in my block, in any case, that we were very sorry we couldn't let them have a drink of brandy. simply because he was so short of spirit, surgical spirit. This is what I was really trying to tell you. This brandy contained a certain amount of alcohol, and we used that as surgical spirit on the advice of our doctors to dress the wounds of those people who were suffering from ulcers through malnutrition. There was a chap in there who I remember very well, a man called Darby, who suffered from diabetes, and of course, had he not been able to get insulin, I think it's insulin, which they use for diabetes, he would have died. Earlier on, we were able to persuade the Japanese this was the situation, so we had supplies of insulin for people in that category. Bandages, we had a good supply of them. If I don't remember anybody requiring an operation, a surgical operation. I can tell you now that when people committed suicide, they committed suicide. There were three cases of suicide, to my knowledge, and I know the names of the people. One was a doctor, which surprised me very much. It took his life. There was one other thing which I think medically should go down, and that was that in the first few months of internment, there was frightful constipation, which is probably understandable from the fact that we were eating nothing but rice and water primarily, and there was trouble in that sort of way.
In the absence of drugs, how were the common diseases actually treated?
Now, the common diseases would be things like malaria more than anything else.
Dysentery, beriberi?
Beriberi was also... a plea would be made for fruit in those cases like that, for beriberi. We also were able, on the advice of our scientists and our doctors who were in turn with us, to persuade the Japanese. I'm talking about the organisation and what we did, and I would know this, being, as I say, in charge of a block. We were able to persuade them to convince the Japanese that if there's one thing that would be useful for us, and that was to get large stores of palm oil. A palm oil was a sort of ready brown substance which had been produced in large quantities in Malaya, and we used to stir this into our rice. The other way in which we improved our diet was to persuade them to let us have supplies of what we used to call stinking fish. If you go down to a Chinese market in Singapore, even today, you can smell this very salty, tangy smell of dried fish, which the Chinese in particular used to sell from their stalls. We got that in, and that was a very valuable component for improving our diet and therefore improving the health of people. It seems incredible looking back on it now to think what we did exist on. For instance, I remember very clearly two pigs were killed, and this was supposed to be a luxury for us. But two pigs were for feeding 3,000 people. So with the result of that, you had a tub more or less swimming of greasy water. And when you went up to collect your rice ration, you would collect a mugful of this greasy water. But it was like manna from heaven, because you poured it over the rice and with the stinking fish and the palm oil you mixed it, it made a jolly good meal. That kind of thing. We persuaded them also to let us have supplies of eggs, the sort of eggs we used to get, which were then on issue of about three boiled eggs, one during a week, two per individual. They were generally duck's eggs. Which were greatly prized because they're much bigger than the ordinary hen's egg. But the duck's egg, I should find it very difficult now in eating a duck's egg, such as I enjoyed then, because it's got a very fishy flavour. The ducks who produced these eggs were generally those ducks in Singapore and so on, which messed around the mud flats off the coast. And they lived on presumably small fish and that kind of thing. It was that. Fruit, we hardly ever saw fruit. There were occasions when we got fruit. I think what we did, really, we had all the experts there to build up all the information that we could think of and which we could lay our hands on in the way of drugs and food in order to combat the deficiencies with which we were faced with regard to our ration.
What was the incidence of sickness in the camp? Was it high or low?
I wouldn't say it was too high. I'm always looking back on it now. I think had we been living or been imprisoned in Europe, many more of us would have died. If the conditions in Europe had been the same as they were for us in the Far East. I think what one has to remember is that when you live in a tropical climate, as we were living in then, it was a warm climate generally, and your body, it's my experience anyway, that one's body really doesn't need as much food as you or I would be accustomed to under civilization. And in fact, it really is quite incredible. And it was demonstrated in that way as to how the human frame will exist in those conditions of really a very little to eat.
I found from my 3 months in Singapore that the occasions when I had European food, I actually found the European food far too heavy. And the indigenous food much more suitable for the climate.
I think you're quite right. I think I really started to love rice, if I may say so, which goes back to my days of internment in Changi Jail. I enjoy a rice meal now. I find it very satisfying, very, very tasty. And if there's anything I can mix into the rice, I thoroughly enjoy the meal in present-day circumstances.
Can I ask you for a few more details about the work activities on camp? What work were you obliged to do by the Japanese?
I think one can answer that in quite a few senses. We were certainly obliged to go out and cultivate vegetables to supplement our rations. We were obliged to have reasonably fit men, and that meant, when I say reasonably fit, men who were reasonably young in those days and were capable of going out on the camp lorry and humping sacks of rice. And some of those sacks of rice could be quite heavy. Basically, they left us alone inside. They were always very worried that the numbers were correct, that nobody had tried to get out. But if you really come to think of it, and I can remember this very well, there was very little chance of getting away, even if you tried to escape. We were tucked down there on the right in the south, near the equator, in Singapore, surrounded by sea, and if you wanted to escape, you would have to have miles and miles of sea lanes to go through before you could get anywhere near land and where the Allies would have been. Those factors were known to them, and provided the numbers were correct every day, they left us very much to our own devices. In fact, I don't think they really knew what to do with us. They wanted to remove us from all circulation with the population outside, as I explained earlier. They put us inside that jail, and they put the most decrepit-looking guards in charge of us, who possibly were not capable of fighting. The camp commandant, we barely ever saw. We people who were responsible for the administration saw them regularly with requests for improvement of our conditions. We were not at all successful in the early days of getting them to acquiesce in what was so necessary for us. And I must say that it was the first 2 years that were the absolute hell, coupled, of course, with the terrible double tents which followed, yes. Which I think I have explained.
Despite all the difficulties, were any attempts made to escape during your time in Changi?
To the best of my belief, nobody made any attempts to escape. I know escapes of others by outside who got cut off. But, I mean, you're asking me primarily about what happened inside Changi Jail.
Right.
And there weren't any attempts to escape, no.
Was it a subject much discussed?
I don't think it was, quite honestly. I think we'd resigned ourselves to the position that we were, first of all, the governor, Sir Shenton Thomas, a most excellent man, had ordered us to stay and suffer with the people who had been overrun, that we were responsible for that country, and we had a duty to stay behind, whatever happened, and share the sufferings of the people, a factor which I really feel has not been given sufficient credence in the story, our story, although I must say that in the House of Lords, and any speech comes up about what the British did, I never fail to mention it.
Was there any formal kind of escape organisation at all?
No.
None at all?
None at all, no.
Okay. You mentioned radio earlier. How did you manage to have radios on camp?
Well, as I've explained to you, we, many of us who were interned, it's rather a long story, but I think I better explain how it is we got them. We people who were interned had for many years been out in Singapore or Malaysia in general, serving the people, and we had established very friendly relations with them. We had engineers, we had people from the wireless station, all known to Asian people outside. And the contacts were established with outside people through the medium of the camp lorry. Frightfully difficult, but the Japanese allowed the lorry party, and I have this on first hand, and I never went with them, to go to a restaurant in Singapore. And the Japanese guard would go out either to buy or to do some shopping on his own, leaving the chaps inside, and contacts were made with outside people, with the result that parts, we could never get smuggle a receiving set into the jail, but parts came in, and we built our own receiving sets in the jail itself. That is just a small example of how it happened.
Where was it set up?
Well, they were hidden. We had a lift with connecting the prison floors, the ground floor, first floor, second floor. So there were three stories of prison landings. One was hidden in the shaft in the lift. One was hidden. I told you about the camp lectures we had. We had a carpentry shop, and a chap locked up a seat on which to sit on. And used to carry the receiving set was inside, strapped to the on the inside of the seat on which he sat, and he would carry this his seat around, and it's the last place a Japanese would think of looking for. It was simple things like that. It's most extraordinary, really. That was one way. The other way, another chap. There were three sets, to my knowledge. I know how they worked. We had an exercise yard, and everybody knows what a prison exercise yard. You've got a concrete slab in the middle, and you've got grass on either side, and you walk round and round. At dead of night, a hole was made in the bank beside the concrete path, which sloped down. The carpenters had made a contraption which you'd fit into this bank, and with turf on top of it, you could open and get into the where the wireless set was kept during the day, and closed the door down, covered with grass on top, which was flush with the bank itself. One was hidden there.
Were the locations widely known?
No, they weren't. I don't think even the internees knew where they were. It was kept dead secret. I mean, it was not safe to record anything, or I'd be exceedingly careful what you told people. The camp commandant knew, we on the camp committee knew where these sets were, and even some of us didn't know.
When you say the camp commandant, do you mean the Japanese?
No, I don't mean the camp. No, not him. No, I'm sorry. The camp, our camp representative, the chairman of our committee knew.
Did the Japanese ever make any searches for radios?
No, they didn't until the double tenth, funnily enough. Although I haven't digressed on that, one reason for them finding the sets, I don't think they ever would have found them, or even suspected we were receiving news of the Allied victories in the Coral Sea, for example. one of the members of the Coral Sea in the last war, and we were hearing all about the American victories down there with their fleet. We were hearing in the jail about Slim's advances in Burma. And we heard about the conferences, the Casablanca conference that Churchill and Roosevelt and all those people went to. Did the Japanese know? They didn't know, although I sometimes think it's incredible that they didn't know, because we were awfully brazen in some respects about what we received. It was fairly obvious we would exhibit, a certain amount of joie de vivre when some good news came through and sort of give a cheer or something like that, which is awfully silly, but they didn't seem to cotton on to all it.
The system of distributing the news, was that on a one-to-one basis?
Yes.
Or were announcements made to groups, like a barrack
group? Groups. They were made to groups. They used to come down from the wireless receiver himself to one block commandant, and he would get his floor representatives together and he would relay it to them, and then it was up to him to go back at night and give them a verbal account of the news that day. Now,
what was the single most exciting piece of news you recollect getting?
I think Monty's advance into where was that? In the Western Desert, the Desert Rats, and we heard, of course, about the Americans landing at Casablanca. I think it was they landed there. I mean, we did all funny things. We went and did obeisance to the lift and sort of Asami to Monty. The funny thing is to keep the spirits up, you know. These were great tonic to us, because if you've suffered as defeat as we had suffered and been so depressed at the way the war in the early stages went against us, anything like this was an absolute tonic. And I don't really think we ever thought for one single moment that we were going to lose the war.
You've explained already something on the side of rations, the food that was available. Mm. But where was it actually, how was it prepared?
It was prepared in the kitchen. I'll come on to this, and it's a very good question. It was prepared in the camp kitchen. Now then, how did we do it? We were very fortunate, although the Allies were unfortunate, that in the last days before the fall of Singapore, the Empress of Asia sailed in with a whole lot of troops and so on, who obviously went straight into prisoner of war camps. But on this sunken British Empress of Asia, there were some cooks from that ship. Liverpool boys, as tough as the earth, as tough as anything, but the salt of the earth they were, and they were interned with us. And there's one place where they could go straight away, and that was into the kitchen. And they became experts in cooking rice on huge great cauldrons, which there were there. The kitchen was designed, of course, to feed 600 convicts. And with a bit of improvisation, they were capable of cooking a very large quantity of rice. The rice was then put into tubs and wheeled to various parts of the block, where the deputy block commandant, which was myself then, we would stand beside the tub, and each attorney would come up with his plate and spoon, and you'd give him a dollar, a ration for the day. That was basically how it was done. It was quite a thing for people to volunteer to work in the kitchen. And I don't think it requires very much imagination to convince you why that was so, because there were, you could get a little bit extra there from if you were working in the kitchen in the way of food. And, I mean, there's always basically some food left over when you're cooking it.
Where was the food taken? Where did you actually eat it?
Well, it was taken from the kitchen. You see, the kitchen was attached. The jail was a complete entity. We had the hospital. We had the kitchen. We had the bathrooms there. So it was taken down the passage to various blocks and distributed like that. rice retains its heat for a very long time in tubs, and it was in a hot hot climate. So we used to get our ration, you know, quite warm and palatable.
And you'd eat it in your block room. There
wasn't
dining.
You'd eat it in your block.
Room.
You'd eat it either sitting in. You'd eat it in the what we call the dining room in each block, or you could take it outside and eat it in the prison yard.
With so few ingredients and rather repetitive ones, was there any ways in which the meals could be made more interesting by ingenuity?
People were most ingenious what they did.
Give me some examples.
Well, of course, they'd mix these eggs in if they got them. There was one chap who used to catch frogs if he could and toast up frogs' legs. And what else did they do? Oh, gosh. They had all kinds of... they were very clever at making some people getting hold of rice and making rice bread. I never went in for that kind of thing, but I mean, I saw people doing the most extraordinary things.
Were any extras? Was it possible to get any extras?
No. Well, that's not really true. Basically, at the end, it was, because when the Bishop of Singapore was Right Reverend Wilson, who was a splendid man, died and brought in a lot of money, we were able to set up what was known as a camp shop. And there were small extras like, what do we have? An extra egg or two and that kind of thing. A bottle of palm oil tea. It was a great luxury to be able to buy